Hi, Jeff. Would you like to join me on the radio here? Yeah. Hey, everybody, guess what? Jeff Tucker just showed up, which is going to make it easy for me to fill time here.
Yeah, no problem.
Let's see, we got mic three hot. Go ahead.
Is this it?
You're on.
Okay, good.
Jeff Tucker, everyone, from Liberty.me and
that's
the Foundation
right.
for Economic Education.
All those things are happening.
Very good to see you.
You too. So often when we talk, it's just over digits, and now here we are in the flesh.
Absolutely.
So you look fabulous.
Well, thank you very much.
Did you bring your skateboard with you?
Dressed to the nines, as always, of course. Yeah.
No, but you didn't bring your longboard with you, did you?
No, I don't have a longboard.
You don't? Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know the right terminology.
No, I did bring a Thrasher magazine that I got at the airport.
Okay.
Skater of the Year, Wes Kremer, and... Hey, doing it right in here, man.
So the idea of skateboarding is to have an element of freedom in your life and total control and autonomy and it's creativity and a certain amount of...
I think, Jeff, I've always been a libertarian.
Yeah, there's certain spontaneous order that comes with a group of skateboarders getting together.
That's true.
I've seen this.
And it's all about individual accomplishment, but with your friends. You don't
skate
against your friends. You skate with them.
Right.
Against yourself.
And you do a cool trick and they cheer you on, and if you mess up, they kind of, you know, bolster you.
And if you nail it, you and only you get the credit. That's what it's really all about,
is actually
making the thing that has been very difficult that you've been unable to make. And then when you make it, then you get to say,
So you set your own standards, basically. I mean, you measure yourself against yourself.
Absolutely.
That's it.
Very individual.
My office used to be next to a sort of a skateboard crowd, and I watched them one day, and I saw exactly a little micro society
in
development. Yeah.
Very
beautiful.
All cheer for each other, too. Here's what you'll always hear at a skateboard session. Yeah!
That's cool. All
right.
I like it. I like everything about skateboarding, but I don't know how. To actually do
the thing. Probably should learn when you're 12 or forget it.
Well, I tried it at a party one time after a few drinks, and I landed on my back.
Probably try before a few drinks.
Right.
A slightly sloped driveway,
right.
See how it goes.
Now,
some people just got the talent. I'm not saying it's too late for you. It might not be.
I don't know what you mean by too late.
Usually you got to learn when you're a kid or you just can't. That's pretty much the deal.
Okay, I get it. Yeah.
Young at heart.
Yeah,
counts sometimes.
But it doesn't sometimes overcome physical reality. Right. So is this your first Liberty Forum?
Yes, this is the first time.
So what do you think? What's your impression? These are your peeps.
Yeah, it's very cool. Now,
yeah.
I have been to New Hampshire once before. I gave a talk to some college students here, to the Young Americans for Liberty in, I don't know if it was in this town or another one, Jeff, honestly. It was 5 years ago, but... I sure like this place. I like the whole idea of the Free State Project and all. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, it's got a great spirit to the conference. This is sort of a can-do, you know, applied liberty sort of thing. So it's not just about theory.
Right.
It's about finding ways to be free in the one life you have. And I think there's really something to say for that. In fact, I think it's kind of a higher level or like Liberty 2.0 or something like that. Like, you know, you get beyond just reading about it or hoping that it happens at some point in your life because... the political winds change or whatever. And you say, to hell with that. I'm going to take freedom into my own hands and do something about it insofar as I'm able and help to build up the institutions of liberty and basically make government as irrelevant as possible, you know? And in that way, hopefully we can make the state obsolete. I think it's happening, actually. I do. More and more so.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think at the very least... this kind of thing is a great way to advertise libertarianism to new people. There's so many Americans who've never even heard the word or had an opportunity to really understand it.
Yeah,
before,
and but for my part, I don't even care if a person adopts that term. What we need is people to sort of, dig deep and find that thing within them that wants to be free. That's more important than anything else. Would you like some Skoal?
No, thank you.
Okay.
I do appreciate it, but I quit tobacco.
I felt rude just dipping here without, offering you some.
So. I am off the nicotine.
Okay.
Permanently.
Okay.
Don't even miss it. In fact, I'm lucky because the wife smokes Marlboro Lights, which I hate and always have hated, so I'm not even tempted to start again.
You mean cigarettes in general you hate?
Yeah, same
difference. Marlboro Lights in particular. I mean,
Marlboro Lights
Camels,
have always been a problem for me, so I'm not tempted to bum one from the wife ever. Now, if she smokes Camel
that's
filters,
why she
I might have given
them.
In.
See, that's why she smokes Marlboro.
I guess so, yeah. I might have given in if it was my brand.
Well, I have a friend who carries only menthol cigarettes because she's convinced that people don't bum them at bars.
That's a good point,
yeah.
I knew a guy in high school like that, too.
Yeah, this is strategic thinking,
absolutely,
really.
Absolutely, yeah.
But what are we talking about today besides this meaningless prattle?
Well, I was thinking I could ask you a little bit about libertarianism
really?
And anti-imperialism. I spoke with a newspaper reporter a little while ago, and I told him that anti-imperialism is at the core of libertarianism. And then right after I told him that, I wondered whether it was really true.
Yeah.
I like to think that it is, Jeff, and it certainly is at the core of my libertarianism.
Well, you know what, though, Scott? You make a very interesting point, because I think in theory you're right. In practice, it's been a long time getting there. You know, if you think about it, libertarianism was sort of, how would you say, maybe it was given life sometime at the end of World War II, mm-hmm. you know, in the American political context anyway. But I think it was another 50 years, essentially, before we sort of got it right. The unity of love of liberty at home with a kind of foreign policy interests, I guess you could say, that were essentially united around the idea of peace. Because for generations, you know, people imagined that you could sort of hold a foreign imperialist aggressive view, garrison sort of state view towards foreign policy, while believing in limited government at home. In fact, my friend, M. Stanton Evans, do you know that name?
It sounds familiar.
Yeah, no, he was a kind of, you know, early person in sort of right-wing circles. You know, he was a friend of Buckley's, and mm-hmm. but also a friend of, he studied under Mises, and a very interesting sort of journalist, Indianapolis News or something like that. But he wrote for Human Events for years. But he was one of these, they called themselves fusionists. Mm-hmm. Frank Meyer was their guru, really.
Right.
And so they had radical libertarian views insofar as it affected economics and even to some extent social policy and that
kind
sort
of hurts the foreign policy, though, to mix it up with the right.
Well, and
well,
then
yeah, we got to take
okay,
this break.
Yeah, we should talk about this more. It's very interesting.
Yeah,
topic.
We'll pick this up on the other side of the break. Talking with the great Jeff Tucker from Liberty.me here live at the Liberty Forum in Manchester, New Hampshire.
It was the Cold War, I think, that drove a lot of it.
That's what I was going to say. Having a communist, which is, again, stupid and crazy and wrong. The Assad regime is harmless. He's never picked a fight with the Israelis. They think makes sense. All right, you guys. Welcome back here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. Now, I hope Ian is going to come and bail me out in 10 minutes.
Oh, is that right? We only have 10 minutes left?
Because then I'm on in 10 minutes after that.
You're on what? You're on Free Talk
I'm on. I'm doing the speech.
You're
at the top of the hour.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay.
So I need Ian to come in and cover my last segment for me. But anyway.
So this is your big chance to lay it all out.
This is
And you're talking about terrorism. That's a big topic.
I got way too much here, Jeff.
Yeah, I know. Well, that always happens to me, too. I end up having like 3 days of speeches, you know. The one time, it was recently, I was invited to Washington to give a talk, and I loved it because I was scheduled to speak from 1 until 5.
Now, see, I could do that. That would be easier for me.
Right?
If I could just not have to worry about running out of time.
I had 200 people in a room from 1 to 5. I gave one break.
Wow.
Yeah. That's ideal.
How many of them came back after the break?
No, everybody was talking. No, and then we still talked afterwards. You know, but I love that because I sort of laid it all out. You know, I just basically broke it down into 4 parts and just turned on and just went straight through from the beginning to the end. I love that. It's a great way to speak. I love having a whole afternoon. I always run out of time. You know, always.
I'm going to do my best to keep you and Anthony Gregory and Tom Woods and mine and other friends of mine who are so good at giving speeches, who just get right up there like they always own the place and just make themselves at home. I get so nervous before I give a speech. It's completely ridiculous.
Yeah, it just means that you need to speak more. That's all.
Yeah.
You need to do more often. That's all. You know,
it's the same speech I give on the show every day. It's
right.
Usually I can't see you and you can't see me. So it feels like
some people get more nervous in that digital realm. They have to have an audience.
Really?
So yeah.
I guess I'm just used to it. I used to get way nervous before the show too.
Did you?
I finally got over it just doing it year after year.
Well, now this
after
is year 12 you've been doing the show. Am I right about that?
Let's see. 98. I can't do math. I started in 98.
Oh, much earlier than I thought. I thought it was 2003.
Now, 2003 is when I started the interview show.
I see.
And then 2007 is when I started really doing a daily show for pay.
Yeah.
So that was in 07. So that's 8 years ago now.
Yeah.
So.
But earlier we were talking about the U.S. foreign policy. policy problem and, and libertarianism. And I do think it's interesting that we went basically 40 years with most people that accepted sort of libertarian ideas for domestic policy, rejected them in terms of international politics. So you had this sort of murderous, you know, sort of longings for nuclear war on the one hand abroad, on the other hand arguing for tax cuts and deregulation at home, which is just, it doesn't really, it doesn't work, really.
And part of it, because the USSR was a communist state, so basically that kind of...
Well,
confused the issue a little bit.
It did, and that was, I think, the whole reason why Harry Truman hatched the Cold War, right? I mean, you know, the goal after World War II was to continue the corporate subsidies. That that was the goal. How do you transfer money out of the American taxpayers into the hands of large corporations that constituted the ruling class that basically benefited from the war, and they wanted to continue to live at others' expense? The best way to do that was to concoct this whole communist scare, you know, which was took some doing. It was an Orwellian trick, because you recall that Russia was our ally,
right?
Gallant, beautiful bringer of democracy to the world during World War II. And then just a few days later, you know, after the war settles down, it's like, whoops, oh, my God. It turns out Russia's really evil, godless communism. They're spreading it all over Europe. We have to stop it. The only way to stop it is through U.S. foreign policy. And hence the Marshall Plan, you know. And
this was a way, you're saying, for Truman to neutralize classical liberalism at home.
And so there was that hysteria about the Greek election. Oh, my God, the Greeks like communists. You know, big surprise there, right? That's always been true, I guess. And so, yeah, it really triangulated everybody on the right. And there's a funny aspect to this, Scott, too, because the people on the right who are just, you know, famously stupid, but they always think they're smart. They were glad for Truman's switch on the Russia question, because they wanted to, this is just bizarre, they wanted to show up FDR, because they really resented, the right wing really resented this, the FDR's road to Moscow, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so they liked this 1947-1948 shift in U.S. foreign policy priorities, because they thought it made FDR look bad. That was part of it. It's like, see, Russia
after 20 years of treason and FDR sucking up to Stalin, now we're going to reverse
that. Now we're going to reverse that, and so he's going to look back. So the right wing supported the Marshall Plan and then jumped on with the Cold War. And there were very few dissenters. You know, one was our beloved St. John T. Flynn, you know, who had his articles, you know, routinely rejected by National Review and died completely in obscurity in something like 1957.
Well, and he had been a classical liberal, not a conservative, correct? Before that?
Yeah. You know, of course, this term conservatism, as far as I can tell, was basically invented after World War II to describe this new form of thinking. Before World War II, they hadn't been organized to anything called a conservative or conservatives. Trotteroff used to say that if you ever called him a conservative, he would punch you in the nose, you know. Mm-hmm. And I really like that. So Russell Kirk invented the term. And it's very strange, because it used to be about, you know, fighting for human rights and liberty and everything. And then under Kirk's tutelage, it became about, you know, watch fobs and large leather chairs and sort of a, you know, fake accents and, you know, phony British style, you know, affectations and, and plus, you know, sort of tipping the hat to U.S. imperialism abroad. The whole thing became just disgusting. Of course, Murray Rothbard was a great outlier in this whole period.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. This apparently was all completely ridiculous on its face to him. Scare the hell out of him, Harry.
It
never worked on Murray.
But, you know, the funny thing about Murray is it would have been so easy for him to just shut up about U.S. foreign policy and to make build a pretty good career for himself. I mean, he was a beloved economist, and he could have been writing for National Review, speaking for the great sort of CIA-controlled right wing, and you know, had a decent life. But you just could not shut Murray up, you know, and he wouldn't stop talking about U.S. imperialism and the essential lies on which the Cold War was based. And he lived kind of a lonely life, really, for a very long time. Do you know there was one point that he was completely out of a job, and he actually started writing encyclopedia entries for a living. Yeah, he actually, and they weren't published, but he was writing like for large scale encyclopedia sets and stuff like that.
It's amazing.
So,
he could be that marginalized.
I know.
To think of
and then finally, in the mid 1970s, of course, you have the early 1970s, the birth of libertarianism as we know it. Today. But even there, I think it took until about 1990 for things to really cohere because, you know, you had to wait
the fall of the USSR.
It was the end of the Cold War, essentially. That's when finally we started getting some sense on among libertarians about U.S. foreign policy. But it's not entirely there, right? I mean, even now.
Yeah, even now, most of the libertarian movement comes from the right. So even if they're kind of, okay, yeah. Tucker, I guess I should be anti-war, like you say,
yeah.
It still doesn't matter that much to them.
But it's there's more anti-war sentiment on the libertarian among libertarians now than I think there's ever been in my lifetime. I mean, Students for Liberty came out with a very beautiful book called, I think it's just, you know, The Case for Peace, something like that. Mm-hmm. Really a good collection of essays. And this is rather new. I think it's good. It's becoming much more the orthodoxy and the hawks and these kinds of people are very much in the minority at these events.
Well, especially, you know, the young people coming up now, the college kids and whatever, they've lived through Bush and Obama, right?
Yeah.
The liberal Republican and the conservative Democrat, the centrist extremists who agree with each other on every single freaking thing. So who could be 20 and not be a libertarian right now? You know?
Oh, I think that's exactly right. And to have some sympathy for people like Edward Snowden and
sure.
You know, I was just at the ISFLC meeting where he spoke, you know, to almost 2,000 students and, you know, like a live feed, you know, video feed from of all places, Moscow, right?
Yes.
I still can't quite, you know, process that. Isn't that something?
Yeah, it's like when John Ashcroft announced that we've turned Jose Padilla over to George Tenet and Donald Rumsfeld to be tortured. He was actually in Red Square giving the announcement in Russia.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Yeah,
the way history turns, it's just extraordinary. Have you seen Citizen Four?
I actually have not. I got it off the Pirate Bay, but I haven't gotten a chance to look at it yet.
Okay, you got it from the right place.
By the way, are you a Pirate Bay aficionado? Because if you're not, you will be.
I'm a huge fan, but I just prefer streaming stuff. And so I stream Citizen 4.
Oh, okay.
And
I could just see you. I could imagine you being the all-time world's greatest champion of the Pirate Bay.
But you know what? Wait till the end of that movie.
Is that the music? Oh, the music's playing. We got it.
Yeah, but you'll see it.
Right back with Jeff Tucker in just a second.
Right at the end of Citizen Four, Obama comes on and calls for the prosecution of Snowden. And I tell you what, if you had any sympathy, it makes me very sad. This is one of my dearest friends. But we've all been. You do. No.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm doing a live remote. I'm excited, man. This is great. I'm at the New Hampshire Liberty Forum in Manchester, New Hampshire, which is a really nice town. I saw it out my hotel window this morning.
How did you learn to work all these buttons? I'm seeing you over there managing this massive machinery.
I'm ignoring most of those.
Okay.
It's this one and this one.
Oh, so you only have two buttons.
Say that you and I are on. Other than that, I'm leaving it alone. This is Ian's territory.
Because it looks complicated to me.
It is. It is.
Like, I feel like I'd have to train for a week.
If my elbow bumps this thing, we're done.
Oh, I see.
I think we're all right. But, yes, Ian Freeman is the one with the computer genius set up here.
He's always doing things, you know.
He's the man that makes LRA run, for sure.
Right. He looks like a DJ, you know, behind the, you know. Right. So earlier we were talking about the whole problem of the ruling class.
Wait.
No, what?
Everybody, it's Jeff Tucker. You know the voice. It's Jeff Tucker.
Really?
Yeah.
But, you know, my voice is a little bit not the way
it
should
be. You have a great radio voice.
Well, thank you. But, you know, I'm a little under the weather right now. So that's what accounts for the sort of manly groveliness.
Makes you sound even better.
There we go. Okay, right.
So it's the great Jeff Tucker from the Foundation for Economic Education.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And from Liberty.me.
That's right.
And he's the my partner in our monthly new show that we
have. We have a great new show.
We've had one new show so far, one episode, the premiere.
And people loved it. It was crowded, and people were all over it.
Eye
on the Empire.
I got great response from
that,
too.
Yeah, I did, too.
And I realized I'm going to have to actually wear a suit to do the show.
Do you think so? You know, I have a bow tie for you if you want. It's up in my room. It's a Liberty.me bow tie. Would you let me put it on you?
Yes.
Okay.
I would.
We'll have to get some of this.
I don't know whether I'll be able to tie it again myself for the next episode
of the
show.
It's just like tying a shoe. It's just like tying a shoe. You tie a shoe,
well,
right?
That I can do.
Yeah, you have you have laces on your shoes.
I do.
Yeah. Okay. Not everybody does.
I've graduated up from Velcro. I'm doing great.
Velcro.
In Manchester, New Hampshire.
That's
rad! I always thought the Velcro was the greatest invention ever. Give that.
Yeah.
Man.
Okay.
Here
that's
I am
a
in the hometown.
Little bit of an exaggeration. I mean, you know, I think it's a good thing. Velcro.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Not ever.
Yeah, I think that was a little over the top, Scott.
Okay, I accept that. I get over the top a little sometimes. All right, so I got Jeff Tucker, the great Jeff Tucker here. Ian Freeman.
Hey.
The man. Uh-oh, I better hit your button here.
Thank you.
Ian Freeman's here from Free Talk Live, and now in about...
I've never been on your show before.
That's true.
Yeah.
Welcome.
We've been working together for years, and I've never been on his show.
I'm very happy to have you here. I'm on in 10 minutes.
Like speaking on.
You have to be out there speaking. Yeah, I have to be out of here and in the other room to get my speech 10 minutes from now, so I'm probably going to bug out of here in a few minutes so I can go and get set up.
For you.
But at the break, we were talking, Jeff, about the interests behind the empire. Now, I think probably, without being the master of all history, I think probably the United States, American Empire, has the greatest public relations in the history of empires. The British public relations was, we are here to kill you and take your grain and starve you to death. All hail the Queen of England or whatever, right?
Yeah.
The Americans pretend that they're killing you for their best interests. Mm. And that's been their shtick, basically, since the end of World War II. In fact, it wasn't until the end of the Cold War that so many conservatives like Chalmers Johnson and Eric Margolies and others went, you know what? We really always were an empire. It wasn't just about containing communism. It really was about expanding world empire. And it took until the end of the USSR
Forty years went by.
So this is some really successful PR. But so tell me, what's the real
truth,
Jeff?
But here's the thing. I think the line that you're presenting here with regard to U.S. foreign policy mirrors the domestic equivalent. You know, every government program is helping people. I mean, even those that are obviously egregious, right? You know, like minimum wage is a great example. Of that, I mean, it keeps people out of the workforce. That's why we had minimum wages in the first place, is keep people from getting jobs. Basically, didn't want those people getting work and propagating themselves. So, but rather than just say that, you know, they say the opposite. The purpose is to help people, and it's the same thing with U.S. foreign policy. So, what is the purpose of the state? That's a big question because. From my point of view, we don't need it. It doesn't actually do anything but steal our stuff and diminish our liberties. So what's its purpose? What's its real function? Why does it exist in the first place? That's a big question. And it took me a long time to figure this out, but I think the answer is actually relatively simple. It's the tool by which the ruling class exploits everybody else. That's it. Mm-hmm. It's not complicated, actually.
Now, is that... kind of Mark Socami of you to call him the ruling class, Mr. Free Market Libertarian?
No, I don't think so.
I prefer parasites.
Yeah, well, that's a decent term. But really, there's a way in which, I mean, the state is exogenous to society, but it also serves the largest interests in society, the largest corporations, the largest financial interests, the biggest banks. And really there is a class structure behind it. Yeah. It was born out of a class structure, at least in the 20th century form.
Well, you know, Gareth Porter is my favorite reporter. If you ever listen to the show, you've heard me interview him 100 times. And he's some kind of leftist or progressive or what have you. But when it comes to the empire, he puts it all on the generals and the spies and the national security state. He says, you know, Lockheed and Citigroup and whatever vested billionaire interests are nothing compared to a bunch of generals with a bunch of ribbons on their shirt. And you give a general a base in Kazakhstan and just watch as he comes up with reasons why he's got to keep it and got to stay and got to get promoted.
But I think aren't all these parts of the ruling class essential in a way? I mean, you have to have the generals, you have to have the corporate interests, you have to have the Federal Reserve to fund all the nonsense. You've got to have the politicians grandstanding. And they all come together in a grand conspiracy.
And that's why they call it We the People.
Yeah, right.
So we won't see it for exactly what it is. Right. Them, the people,
it's
versus
the rest
of us.
It's very difficult to see this, actually. This truth is guarded in a way. And we're protected from it because of the language of the left and the language of the right, which are in many ways like mirror images of each other, but neither one is really telling the truth about what's going on.
Yeah, very fair point.
So, this is a very interesting topic. I think I'm going to make it the whole topic of my Sunday speech. I've got it pretty well mapped out. In fact, it's the subject of my next book.
Oh, great. You know, there have been quite a few books written recently. There's one called American Coup by William Arkin, who not a libertarian at all, former Washington Post reporter. And there's quite a few books like
this. What's
Tim
the coup?
Shorrock did
it. Is the post 9/11?
Yeah, post 9/11 about the rise of the homeland security state. And if you thought we had a national security state after 1947, the homeland security state that has grown up since September 11th. Oh, and the national security state too, but just. And this is really kind of the Cheney policy. It's that weird, bastardized, should be spelled different version of privatization of government functions.
Yeah.
It's not libertarian privatization where the government goes to hell and lets the market take care of it. It's where the government hires mercenaries to carry out all their dirty work. Edward Snowden was not an NSA. He was at Booz Allen Hamilton,
true
right?
Enough, yeah.
Working for the NSA. And they have just contracted out so much of this. And remember in the Iraq War where Halliburton or, say, Blackwater would kill somebody. And they would say, well, so who's going to prosecute him? And the American courts would say, well, it's not up to us. Ask the military. And the military would say, well, it's not up to us.
Guys,
ask the Iraqi courts. And the Iraqi courts will say, well, Bush won't give us jurisdiction over Blackwater guys. I guess you're going to have to ask the Department of Justice. And they're getting away with murder, basically, because no one's really in charge.
Pass
the buck. There is no system set up for any kind of accountability for these guys. And we have just, it's almost unmeasured. It's almost as invisible as the rest of the state that's been built in secrecy since September.
You know what 11? It reminds me of, as you're talking, it reminds me of very much the way the pre-modern states functioned. They were more or less sort of private exploitation agencies. Mm-hmm. The king would give certain monopolistic privileges to certain people to go out and collect taxes or wage war or whatever, and they could do what they want so long as they paid the king, you know, some portion of the proceeds, and then otherwise they would get protection from the king, you know. But other than that, they didn't really work directly for the king. They worked for themselves, and they were more or less hired, you know, but they were private. Private exploitation agencies.
More things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah,
a little bit of just reverting
back to form.
But
you know, it's funny because the idea of liberalism is that no, that's shit. We should have laws, you know, and the state should have defined functions and stuff like that, you know. But of course, we're living in a post-liberal age in a sense. The state has become truly, truly total. It has been for a while, I would say. In fact, I kind of resist some of this language about the coup, post 9/11 coup, because in many ways it was a follow up to what everything the state aspired to do before 9/11. You know, it wasn't as if it was a sudden transformation. We were once free and now we're not.
You know what the real coup was? The coup was in getting the American people to repeat the mantra that everything changed. Go ahead and have your way with me now.
Right.
Everything changed. That was the coup. Because before that, okay, you know, maybe we've got a crisis, but this is still America, and we still have our Constitution.
And to put up with the
we
police
still believe
state.
In liberty and justice, right? And then, no, everything changed. Liberty and justice are now last on the list.
Now, martial law have to be a permanent state of being, basically, yeah.
All right, that's the music. I'm done. Thanks to everybody,
okay.
Live audience.
Hey, Scott.
I really like having a live audience. It's great. You make me very nervous, but I appreciate it. I'm on in room C here in just a minute. Thanks for listening.